You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall. Kenji, what do you have for us today?
I'll be talking about North Korea-South Korea talks over a closed industrial park, Japan's attempt to solidify its claims over hundreds of islands, and Taiwanese military exercises that simulate an attack by China.
Kenji will be joining us shortly, plus, brace yourselves, it's back.
The incredible Datsun 210 hatchback. It's the highest gas mileage car you can buy.
Yes, Nissan is reviving its iconic Datsun brand. We ask what the Japanese car maker will have to do to revive its success too.
Also ahead, a rare victory for human rights in China. A court has granted compensation to a mother who was sent to a labor camp for defending her daughter. We'll ask what this means for Chinese justice.
And we'll hear about a company that sells peace and quiet to those whose lives are filled with unwanted noise.
Washing machines to cars, dishwashers, kettles, garden tools, but also some more unusual things like quiet instruments and acoustic clouds, all sorts of solutions to sound insulate your home or workplace and make it a little bit quieter, more peaceful and supportive.
Well, nothing on this program will be unwanted noise. We're also going to play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Okay, let's get things started on today's Midori House then. With your news, here's Paul Osborne.
There have been further clashes overnight in Cairo as supporters of Egypt's ousted president took to the streets once again. At least 22 people were injured in the latest violence when Mohamed Morsi's supporters tried to block bridges crossing the River Nile. It happened hours after a senior US official met Egypt's interim leaders. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns said Egypt had been given a second chance to install a working democracy.
It seems to me, based on my conversations over the last day and a half and previous conversations in Egypt, that Egyptians understand very well the dangers of polarization, the risks that escalating tensions amongst different parts of this society can pose to the chances of genuine reconciliation.
The man in charge of a violent drugs cartel in Mexico has been captured close to the U.S. border. Miguel Angel Trevino Morales was stopped in a pickup truck containing $2 million in cash. He took control of the Zetas gang after the group's founder died last year. Morales is accused of being behind a series of attacks in Mexico in which hundreds of people have been killed. The U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder has described the killing of an unarmed black teenager in Florida as tragic and unnecessary after a man was cleared of his murder. There have been protests across the country after George Zimmerman was acquitted of killing Trayvon Martin, but he could still face charges under a federal hate crimes law. Mr. Holder promised the case will not be forgotten.
I believe that this tragedy provides yet another opportunity for our nation to speak honestly about the complicated and emotionally charged issues that this case has raised. We must not, as we have too often in the past, let this opportunity pass.
Peace talks between the Colombian government and the FARC rebel group are close to a breakthrough, according to the rebels' lead negotiator. But Ivan Marquez says it's important not to rush the talks, which are being staged in Cuba. He says 5 decades of fighting, in which around 600,000 people are believed to have died, could soon be over. For a fourth night, there have been riots on the streets of Belfast in Northern Ireland. Petrol bombs were thrown at police, who responded with water cannon. The violence followed the decision to block an Orange Order parade staged by members of Northern Ireland's loyalist community. Australia's Prime Minister is to speed up the scrapping of the country's controversial carbon tax. Kevin Rudd has moved quickly to abandon a key policy of his predecessor, Julia Gillard, who he ousted last month as leader of the Labour Party. With an election due within weeks, Mr. Rudd has insisted his plan to impose a new emissions trading scheme will help people save money.
This is a big change. Treasury modelling tells us that this will reduce pressures on consumers and on businesses. Every Australian should be clear about the government's new ETS and that it will leave average families $380 per year better off.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. It is 5 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Norrie House on Monocle 24. And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, today we're joined by Kenji Hall. He is Monocle's Asia editor at large. He's joining us from our Tokyo bureau right now. Kenji, many thanks for joining us on the program. Shall we begin with Taiwan and a military drill?
Sure. So Taiwan has just started a computerized military drill yesterday. It's a 5-day exercise that's part of the island's biggest annual military maneuver. In this particular case, the drill simulates a surprise attack by China in the year 2017, followed by a large-scale invasion. We haven't heard any explanation as to why the scenario is being staged in that particular year, but it seems reasonable according to some analysts.
No details on exactly why these very specific and slightly provocative set of circumstances are being prepared for. It is pretty provocative, isn't it? What's the reaction been in China?
Well, I haven't actually seen any reaction in China so far. I'm sure we'll see some over the coming days. At this point, if you talk to analysts, they'll tell you that China is putting into service a lot of new equipment, aircraft carriers, stealth planes, amphibious assault ships. And China's Taiwan is essentially preparing for the possibility. I think the irony here is that tensions across the Taiwan Strait have actually eased under President Ma Ying-jeou's China-friendly administration. He came to power back in 2008. And if you look at trade in general, cross-strait business relations have rarely been better. Just last month, we saw Taiwan and China agree to further reduce trade barriers and open up their retail, travel, and services industries. It's kind of a head-scratcher.
And Kenji, you mentioned that the drill simulates a surprise attack by the Chinese that's followed on by a large-scale invasion. Can you give us any details of what the actual scenario is, what they're actually planning for in this scenario?
It's a good question, but at this point, there are very few details. Taiwan rarely releases anything more than the fact that it's conducting these annual military maneuvers. And so at this point, we don't actually know what sort of scenarios it is preparing for.
Okay, well, let's move on to another story which shares a little bit of DNA in terms of islands and who owns them and the protecting of them. Japan's moving to nationalize 400 different islands.
That's right, and this is essentially an administrative move. Japan may assert greater control over its most remote islands. There are, as you mentioned, around 400 or so, half of which are unnamed, many of which haven't actually been explicitly identified as Japanese territory. Japan wants to define its borders, specifically its 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, which under a UN treaty gives the country the right to drill for natural gas and oil, and also gives the country fishing rights.
How provocative do you think this move is, Kenji, especially when you think that they have these disputes with China, with Taiwan, with South Korea? How provocative do you think this move is going to be seen in the region?
Well, two things here. As you mentioned, I think the timing of this is obviously connected to Japan's territorial dispute with China over the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. China also claims those islands and calls them the Diaoyu Islands. Just remember, last September, Japan's purchase of 3 of the Senkaku Islands from a private owner provoked a spiraling in relations between Japan and China. So this could provoke a similar response from Beijing. At this point, we haven't seen any.
I mean, the confusing thing about this move, I suppose, is that there are 400 islands. Obviously, some of them are very small. A lot of them are very remote, have never been owned, have basically nothing on them. Is this Japan sort of marking out physically the territory that it wants to be considered its on a map, effectively?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's clearly Japan marking its territory. You know, Japan is a country that is has few natural resources other than its oceans. And I think when you consider the fact that there could be natural gas and oil, and obviously the exclusive rights to fishing, this is a big deal for Japan.
And is this also part of perhaps Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's broader policy of perhaps having a more nationalist stance?
Well, you could question whether there's some political motive here for announcing this when it's been announced. This Sunday, we're expecting the upper house elections. This could be Prime Minister Abe's attempt to rally political support ahead of those elections. So, you know, at the same time, Japan could be creating a lot of problems for itself. It has competing claims for territory with South Korea, with Taiwan, and with Russia. So we could see those countries as well stepping in to you know, enforce their own attempts over the islands.
Kenji, let's talk about a little bit of space between North and South Korea, the industrial zone. The talks started up and then sort of shut down on this very quickly about a week ago. What's the latest on these?
So the latest is that North and South Korea have failed once again to agree to reopen the Kaesong Joint Industrial Complex. Talks were held yesterday. They were held on July 6th and July 10th. This is, as you mentioned, the third round. The next meeting is on Wednesday. The two are still far apart on preconditions to reopening the park. They both obviously want to reopen the park because both sides benefit. And yet, you know, South Korea wants assurances that North Korea won't pull out its 53,000 workers as it did back in April. North Korea wants the industrial zone to reopen without any preconditions at all. So it's difficult to see how the two sides will bridge this gap.
But the North must realize that this industrial complex is far more important to them than it is for South Korea. There's, as you mentioned, 53,000 North Korean workers there. That's compared with just 800 workers from South Korea. So surely there must be some give and take, at least on the part of the North.
Absolutely. I think North Korea knows that it's that this is clearly a benefit to itself. This complex is a huge source of foreign exchange for North Korea. At this point, you know, North Korea is not budging, and it's not clear whether it will.
Give us an idea of quite how significant this industrial zone is, you know, as an emblem of the peace process between the two sides.
Absolutely. So this was conceived in 2004 at a time when there was a thaw in North and South Korean relations. It's supposed to symbolize cooperation, and it does so between two countries that are sworn enemies. So the symbolic significance here is enormous. If the two sides can find a way to reach a compromise, it could lead to a thaw in relations once again. But at this point, heightened tensions remain.
You say heightened tensions there. It's the 60th anniversary since the end of the Korean War at the end of this month. What's the sense in South Korea towards this industrial complex? Is there a sense that people are just fed up with the North and they just want to move on? They kind of have, you know, they've accepted the fact that relations are probably not going to be normalized in their lifetime?
It's a good question because you're asking about unification. You're asking about whether South Koreans believe it will actually happen. I think you'll see a generation divide here between the elderly people who remember a time when families and friends were split apart by the division of the Korean Peninsula versus younger people who grew up in a richer South Korea. They identify more with the West and with wealthy countries. And so, you know, the question as to whether they think that unification will actually be achieved, whether relations between North and South will actually improve, is very complex.
Kenji, thanks very much. Lots of unanswered questions still there. We do appreciate your time. Kenji Hall, he is our Asia editor at large. Thank you very much for joining us indeed and for setting the agenda here on Midori House.
Coming up, yet more scrutiny on China's labor camp re-education. Could the successful appeal of a woman mark the end of the system?
If design is your beat, then tune into Section D, our weekly show delving deep into the latest developments in the worlds of architecture, fashion, furniture, product development, tech, and many more.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
No matter what the sphere, we'll be here with expert insights, news and exclusive interviews on all things design. So switch on to Section D every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House. The time is 15:16 in Shanghai. It's 8:16 here in London. Now, Tang Hui's 11-year-old daughter was the victim of an incredibly brutal crime. She was abducted, raped, and prostituted by a gang of men. Tang Hui wanted the harshest possible punishment for her daughter's attackers, but when she petitioned for it, she was sent to a labor camp for a year and a half.
Hui's case caused a public outcry and she was let off her sentence within days. But yesterday she won a rare victory against the state. She got compensation for her treatment. Now, the compensation doesn't amount to much in monetary terms, a little more than $400. But how valuable might it be as a signal of change? Could the Communist Party's system of using labour camps to punish its critics now be on shaky ground? Well, Raffaello Pantucci is our regular contributor. He's in Shanghai at the moment and he joins us on the line. Raffaello, thanks for joining us on Midori House. Give us an idea of quite how sort of serious the outcry against this, the treatment that Tang Hui had was.
Well, I mean, the outcry has been huge. I mean, what's interesting is the amount of coverage that's been getting in the press here. And you've got sort of some of the traditional, party mouthpieces like the People's Daily coming out with opinion editorials supporting her case. I mean, the whole story is scandalous sort of from start to finish in the very act of what happened to her 11-year-old daughter who was brutally kidnapped and assaulted and then prostituted. And to the fact that it took her then 2 years of petitioning. I mean, she essentially was involved in first getting her daughter freed from these people. It then took her pestering the local authorities for 2 years to get them to actually act and do something. And then once they finally did, the seven people they arrested, she says this isn't all of the people for one thing. And then she says that the crimes against them weren't ample. And then in continuing to sort of petition and pester the local authorities to do something about this, she herself was incarcerated. And I mean, so this whole story has been playing out, for 7 or 8 years now. And so this sort of culmination of it with her getting sent to this camp and the sort of massive public outcry that came out as a result, it's incredible in the way that it really has, as I say, captured everyone's sort of attention.
Well, as Dominic mentioned, she was awarded compensation, some $479 in compensation. How surprising was this verdict?
I mean, I think the verdict, the monetary sum was clearly a nominal thing. I mean, it's clearly more of a face issue than everything else, and she's been validated for all her pushing and over the years. And then the other question is, what this means for the re-education through labor camp. This is what a lot of people are talking about. I mean, this is essentially a sort of parallel judicial system that exists whereby, the government or local authorities can imprison people, incarcerate people for really up to 4 years with no sort of due process. The idea here is that the punishment is one that's being meted out for essentially it's political subversion, but they can sort of paint that political subversion notion in a very large way. Here, she is getting, she was getting accused of essentially obstructing authorities' capacity to go around and do their day-to-day jobs. And the question is what this means for that. And does this sort of, this very nominal amount of money, but it's a bit of a smack in the face for this system of re-education through labor camps. And the question becomes, does this open up the debate about whether this system should be eliminated or should be changed in the system? There's some evidence from the new Xi Jinping administration, some of the new few people who've been sort of moving around within the party, that there is talk about maybe trying to reform this system. But, you know, and this could be seen as a signal from the judiciary that maybe this is the way things should go.
But the state still has some wiggle room, doesn't it? I mean, the fact is this was a case about compensation. There was no, I believe, no admission of wrongdoing attached to the award of compensation. So does the state still have potentially some room to manoeuvre, given it hasn't technically admitted that the original sentence was wrong?
No, it hasn't. And, you know, and at the end of the day, one could say in this case, you know, you have two people who are executed for this crime and another three for, you know, given life sentences and two more 15-year sentences. I mean, these are quite substantial jail terms for what was nonetheless a horrible crime. So, you know, some sense of that sort of the judicial system does seem to work. And you're right in the sense that the government hasn't locked itself in. But I think the fact that it's opened up this whole conversation, it's opened up this whole debate about the political, about the judicial system and rule of law in this country, I think has made people start to think about it and is a bit of an admission that there is a recognition this discussion is happening. I think the other element to remember is the fact that it was really through her petitioning that anything was actually done in the first place, which means that essentially the system ignored her for a long time and ignored this crime and didn't do anything about it. And it took her going to pester the local authorities or petitioning them, I mean, even trying to go to Beijing to petition government officials there, for them to actually act on something that was clearly quite a sort of blatant criminal act.
Raffaello Pantucci of RUSI, who is in Shanghai today. Thanks, as ever, for being with us on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. This is Monaco 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Hey, wish you owned a truck full of gas? Well, now you can own a car full of gas mileage. The incredible Datsun 210 hatchback. It's the highest gas mileage car you can buy.
There we go. After 30 years, Nissan is about to revive that, its iconic Datsun brand. And in case the name doesn't ring a bell, let me refresh your memory. In the 70s, the Datsun became one of the most popular compact cars in an era of sky-high petrol prices. It was almost instantly recognisable with its square shape and, let's say, interesting colour choices, the most popular ones being orange, red or brown.
Interesting
brown.
Indeed.
Really? I mean, brown is really a colour that hasn't
taken off, has it?
Weathered much since the 70s.
Well, Nissan killed off the Datsun more than 30 years ago, as Dominic mentioned, but in a bid to capture more of the emerging market, it's bringing the car back for a new lease on life. So what can we expect from this new 21st century Datsun, and will sales head into high gear? Well, joining us now in studio to look at the return of this iconic car is Tim Pollard, managing editor of MSN Cars. Tim, thanks very much for joining us here in the studio. So the Datsun is back. How surprising is this?
Well, Nissan announced this last year, that they were bringing back this budget brand. A lot of car manufacturers are moving into this space. They know that in markets like China, India, emerging territories where people aren't really owning cars and they've got vast populations, massive opportunity. And they don't want to go around driving BMWs or they can't afford to go around driving those cars yet. So coming up with a budget brand who can offer back-to-basic, simple motoring, it's a massive opportunity, and that's what Nissan's doing here.
So, what, I mean, there are all sorts of options if you want to deliver a compact car to emerging markets and you know, sort of corner that market of people who might be buying their first car or upgrading from a motorbike, for example, to an initial vehicle. Why does it need to be the Datsun, then?
Well, it's a good point. I mean, I think Nissan doesn't have a huge amount of success in India. They have less than 2% of the market, and it's a sort of relatively modest sized market at the moment, but it's the long-term prediction is it's going to skyrocket. So they're not well known at the moment. You know, no better thing to do really than come up with a new brand which they can market correctly, try and tap into this new generation. They're calling them risers. They've identified a young breed of Indian people who they aspire, as you say, to own a car rather than a moped. And this is a big sort of opportunity for them. It's a sort of first step up a ladder. And if they get it right, the potential you know, rewards could be massive in the long term.
First step on the ladder for Indians who want a car. Many Indians, or many car experts as well, will know, of course, the Tata Nano. That's the world's cheapest car. It was launched in India. It sells for about half the price of this new Datsun. Do you think Datsun and Nissan have perhaps missed a beat in terms of the pricing on this, if they're trying to capture this part of the Indian market?
I think they've, if you look at yesterday's announcement, they've been really coy about the sort of the terminology and the language they use. They've been saying it's going to cost less than 400,000 rupees. So the door is open to, you know, to get closer to the Nano. I think what most people are saying after the announcement yesterday by Carlos Ghosn, the chief executive, he was talking about less than 400,000 rupees. That's around $6,700, 4,500 British pounds. Now, less than is crucial. How much less than, we don't yet know. And there's some talk that in the sort of medium term, they probably will bring out a really pared back, stripped out version, which will cost only a little bit more than the Nano. That's what sort of they're talking about. But I think it's quite common in the car industry to launch with a model which is slightly higher. You know, in the UK as well, people generally launch with the bigger engines, and then over time they'll bring in the more pared back, you know, stripped down, take some of the value out, get a lower price, kickstart sales a bit more. So I suspect that will happen, although it's not going to be as cheap as the Tata Nano.
Okay, well, I mean, what do people need to consider when, if a manufacturer is launching a new brand at this market in these sort of emerging economies, what is it just about price? What are the sort of main things? If I'm launching a car, tell me what I need to think about.
Well, they talked about this at some length yesterday in the announcement in Delhi when the sort of the Datsun Go was first shown, and clearly price is crucial. In these markets, you know, people don't have a lot of disposable income. You've got to price it correctly so people can actually afford to get it. But people must want to have it as well. There's got to be a degree of aspiration. I think a lot of the brands who are seeing success in markets like India, China, etc., some of these, you know, big growth markets, it's for ones who market them correctly and have the right product. So if you look at the car, it's pretty basic to you or me, you know, who are used to driving in London, say, where, you know, we're used to lots of toys, but it's not completely stripped out. It's got air conditioning offered. It's got twin electric windows, you know, niceties which 30 years ago we might have been jumping up and down about, but over there, that's pretty something, really. And the styling too, again, to our eyes, it probably looks a little bit basic, but over there, you know, it's simple, it's pretty timeless, and they've not made it too edgy, or they don't want to deter people. They want to make it sort of welcoming. If you look in the front seats, it's quite interesting. It's got a bench, so you can actually get six people in rather than the five that would be more typical over here in Europe.
Do you think that, you know, car makers obviously pinning lots of the hopes on these emerging markets like China, Brazil, India, but just do you think they're pinning a bit too much of their hopes on this? And I only say this because just looking at the recent auto figures out of India, car sales there fell for the eighth consecutive month. Do you think it's a bit too risky?
I think we have to take that in context. You're right, it has been 8 months on the trot for slowing car sales in India. But if you look at the size of a country now, you know, it's one of the most populous countries on earth. There's 1.2 billion people live there, I think, in India, according to the last census. And yet they only sell 1.9 million cars. Now, that's roughly the same size as the UK car market. So you can see that the potential there. I think this is a short-term blip. I think the long-term future is for massive growth. And I'd be very surprised if we sat down in 10 years' time and had a similar conversation if that hadn't happened. So, yes, I've seen those figures. It's like the figures coming out of China, looking at the economy in China, you know, slowing growth, but still growth. Yeah. And I think, you know, these countries are one of the big sort of bright spots on the map for car makers. If you look at Europe is stagnant. America, okay, it's picked up car sales there, but a lot of manufacturers have they've invested so much time and so much of their plans into these emerging markets. I'd be surprised if they're proved wrong in the long run.
Well, talk to us more generally then about how Nissan is doing. I mean, this is a pretty confident move. It's a bold move to sort of a land grab for a particular sector of the market. How is Nissan getting on generally?
Well, I think what's interesting about this is that Nissan is obviously part of Nissan-Renault, a big alliance, and they've done a similar thing with Dacia. So Renault has got its own budget brand, Dacia. That's proved to be working. Nissan has its own premium brand, Infiniti, which is in America, it's really strong. Less so in Europe. It has launched over here, but you know, you don't really see many Infinities on the roads in the UK. And they've got, you know, bold plans for it, and it's worth pointing out that Carlos Ghosn is a he has a very good track record of executing his plans. He particularly the first 10 years of his reign, you know, he turned Nissan around. He, times have been faltering a bit more of late, but you know he's got a good track record. And I think what they're doing now, they're trying to sort of replicate what we've done with Dacia for Renault with Nissan. So Nissan now has its own budget brand, Datsun. They've got Infiniti at the top end. Renault doesn't really have anything at the top end. They're talking about bringing Alpine back, which is the sort of sports car brand for Renault. But it's also that we can. His strategy is now coming into play. So they're trying to sort of cover at the bottom of the market. The mainstream brands, Nissan and Renault, well, they're kind of chuntering along, but people are moving away from the mainstream, particularly in Europe. People don't really want to have a mainstream volume car. They want to, they aspire to have more. So it's quite a clever move to get these brands in above, and then obviously in the emerging markets, as they try and bring Renault and Nissan up a bit to make more attractive, there's a gap at the bottom. So I think it's an interesting time to be watching them, and it's a, you know, quite a big gamble, this one.
Tim, we will see how that gamble pays off, and we'll watch those sales figures. Tim Pollard is managing editor of MSN Cars. Thanks for coming in this morning.
From London
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Shanghai
to Jakarta
to Moscow
to Los Angeles
to Beijing
to Yokohama
to Amsterdam
to Cairo,
to Karachi,
to Bogota, all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. In the next half hour, we'll be checking in with our correspondent in Mali. We'll also be getting a preview of Section D this week, and we'll talk about unwanted noise. But before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest world news.
There have been more clashes overnight in Cairo as supporters of Egypt's ousted President Mohamed Morsi took to the streets again. At least 22 people were injured in the latest violence when his supporters tried to block bridges over the River Nile. It happened hours after US Deputy Secretary of State William Burns met Egypt's interim leaders. The man in charge of a violent drugs cartel in Mexico has been captured close to the US border. Miguel Angel Trevino Morales was stopped in a pickup truck with more than $2 million in cash. He took control of the Zetas gang after the group's founder died last year. The peace talks between the Colombian government and the FARC rebel group are close to a breakthrough, according to the rebels' lead negotiator. But Ivan Marquez says it's important not to rush the talks, which are being staged in Cuba. He says 5 decades of fighting could soon be over. For a fourth night, there have been riots on the streets of Belfast in Northern Ireland. Petrol bombs were thrown at police. They responded with water cannon. The violence followed the decision to block an Orange Order parade staged by members of Northern Ireland's loyalist community. And the US Attorney General Eric Holder has described the killing of an unarmed black teenager in Florida as tragic and unnecessary. There have been protests across the country after George Zimmerman was acquitted of the murder of Trayvon Martin, but he could still face charges under a federal hate crimes law. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. Paul will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. But you are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Now, the last thing that you want to hear when settling down in your garden for a moment of peace and quiet, I suspect, is the roar of your neighbour's engine or the whine of a hedge trimmer. When we're designing the ideal home or garden, it seems we often overlook the need for some quiet and for factoring in low-noise technology. Now, there is a charity which is at the forefront of finding solutions for unwanted noise, and it's called the Noise Abatement Society.
Its distinctive purple mark of approval, the Quiet Mark, is awarded to those companies who have developed silent products that harmonize our living spaces, from hybrid cars to sound barrier fences and even the odd acoustic cloud. Well, Monocle's Alexa Firmenich paid a visit to their first outdoor soundscape experience at the RHS Flower Show. She caught up with the Quiet Mark's managing director, Poppy Elliott, for this week's edition of Section D.
So we've got the Epiphany Orchestra, who are playing on silent instruments, you know, a violinist,
drum player, flute, keyboard. Yesterday we had a cello as well. And we're doing like a world first for sound portraits, where people can have a personal musical portrait done of them as they sit in front of the band orchestra improvise, and basically reflect kind of what they sound like. Not what they look like, but what they sound like. So that's what we're experiencing here right now.
And what would be the use of a silent orchestra? You know, isn't the whole point of music to be heard out loud?
Well, absolutely. But often when lots of musicians want to practice, they're living themselves in like close proximity to their neighbours, and they don't want to be practicing, you know, for hours. It's just a way to still have excellence of sound, but you're not disturbing neighbours. And it's also quite an amazing experience to like just put the headphones on and be kind of in a secret world where you can hear the music and no one else can.
So let's take a listen.
We basically treasure hunted about 35 product categories from all over the world, from everything washing machines to cars, dishwashers, kettles, garden tools, but also some more unusual things like quiet instruments and acoustic clouds, all sorts of solutions to sound insulate your home or workplace and make it a little bit quieter, more peaceful and supportive. Yeah.
How does sound affect us? I know that you say that it has a detrimental effect on our health, especially these days where we have so much information coming in.
I think we're starting to realize just how much it does affect us. I mean, sound is just as important as light, and we're always concerned with the visual, but actually the oral has just as much impact on us, and that design in any kind of product or living space also we feel very strongly should be considered as well, so that it supports our health, our productivity, happiness. And when you get the sound right, you have a whole different experience in your day.
Do you find that people are getting more concerned now about the sound within their homes? Is this a trend that you're starting to see?
Very, very much so. Yeah, it's happened quite suddenly over the past year or so. I think product designers are looking to raise the agenda in terms of investment in that area of products. I think maybe because we've got like technology golden age where everything's tech and you get like an orchestra of sounds around you. It's great that the stuff does great stuff for you, but there's also a whole load of noise and sounds and beeps and what have you that you have to also endure. And I think we're all looking to a place now where we have to kind of run away and get a few bit of peace and quiet just to then go back and enter the world again.
And actually, maybe I could explain a little bit about where we are right now, because it sounds very peaceful, but outside there's a lot of things going on. We're in a little hut.
Yeah, we've called it My Quiet Hut, and it's a little shepherd's hut. And we've got little acoustic clouds. It's been sound insulated. It's like a grown-up Wendy house, basically. Really, really beautifully wood-made, tailor-made, bespoke-made, so that you can have a little place in your back garden or wherever you are. You can just go to just to sit and, I don't know, meditate, pray, have a moment on your own, just to regroup and download, yeah.
These acoustic clouds, I described them before as carpets in the sky. These are just some of the items that you're featuring now on the show today. Maybe you could describe some of the other things that we've been looking at.
Yeah, we've got represented all different areas of outdoor technology. So you've got the state-of-the-art commercial lawn care, very, very quiet, or the quietest lithium-ion battery garden tools, which are really high performance, but like don't annoy your neighbours so much. We've got the very quiet hybrid cars, so from Lexus, the IS and the CT, which are hybrid, so very powerful, but also have a beautiful sound quality inside the car and outside. We have very powerful industrial fans, so a lot of, especially in this hot weather, amazing cooling down, but you can hardly hear them, and all sorts of other amazing little bits of tech to make our world a little bit more peaceful, and acoustic fencing and barriers to stop neighbour noise, yeah.
Hi there, I'm Andy from Makita, UK. Just like to demonstrate the 25cc petrol two-stroke engine for you. Just like to start that up now for you. Okay, from going one extreme to the other, this is our lithium brush cutter. So basically just demonstrate that for you noise-wise.
Okay. There's quite a big difference, no?
Yeah, it's the sound quality. It's a much like softer noise. You're not going to kind of, you know, annoy your neighbours so much with that one. It's just it's still powerful, but it's just the sound is a bit softer.
Do you think that the issue is that we just have maybe too many machines these days in our everyday lives? And I mean, one measure is to make them more silent, but do you have any sort of ideas about initiatives to maybe bring in less machines?
I think it's a question of machines are very, very useful, but often the investment hasn't been made in the design process for the acoustics of the machines. Now, loads of manufacturers are now really thinking this through. And I think the ultimate is finding a really high-performance machine that does the job, but you have a beautiful sound quality. I mean, in a fantasy land, you know, what about a washing machine that sounds like birds singing? You know, or, you know, anything's possible to make basically sound supportive around us. Sound is beautiful. It's the unwanted noise we want to get rid of, the kind of like grating, irritating. Sound is so complex in its dimensions. And if we can maybe understand that more, then, yeah, I think that would sort of help us on a daily basis, yeah.
Because actually one of the other questions I wanted to ask you was, you know, how do you feel about the other extreme? Maybe too much silence is bad in itself as well, instead of too much sound.
Well, I've never had that much silence to know the detrimental effects. I think if we look at, you know, say, you know, the monastic life that some, I don't know, you know, nuns or what have you, or people go away to have a retreat. I think when you're silent, you can hear that still small voice of calm, and you can actually receive ideas, direction in that place of stillness that you just can't hear when you've got so much going on. It's almost like you're just battling to survive sometimes with the sound that comes at you in the everyday journey through, I don't know, an urban environment or where you're living in your home.
Yeah. And where do you feel that the responsibility lies to make our lives more peaceful and quiet? Do you think it's more of an individual thing? Do you think that companies should be doing it? Do you think maybe even the government should be getting involved?
Well, we are actually supported by DEFRA, the Department of the Environment. So the government are already, you know, cheering this on. I think basically we've all got ears. We're all consumers. We all have this technology. We really don't, there's nobody that hasn't got a phone now or a washing machine or a car or what have you. So I think it's something that we've all got to make a choice when we go and buy a product. As much as the pollution of like smoking is now, you have to do it outside a building or it's in a separate place, that if we all choose to buy quiet, then the world will become more peaceful.
We just thought we'd give you a bit of quiet time.
That was peaceful, wasn't
it? And that was Poppy Elliott there speaking to Monocle's Alexa Firmanich for this week's edition of Section D. And of course, you can catch it tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a review of what's making the news in Mali.
That was some nice quiet time. But we're back to normal here on Midori House.
Yes.
Where the time here in London is 8:41.
And it's time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And we are indeed going to Bamako in Mali to catch up with our woman there, Alex Duval-Smith. Alex, welcome back to Midori House. Let's talk about some news which first started to be leaked over the weekend. And we got confirmation yesterday during a speech by President Hollande. Tell us what's been happening.
Indeed, that was the unfortunate news that the French hostage Philippe Verdon, a 53-year-old mining engineer, had been killed. He was abducted with another mining engineer, Serge Lazarevich, in November 2011 in Hombori, in the centre of Mali, and they were abducted by one of the hostage-taking organisations, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, most probably. And there were different sort of conflicting reports throughout his captivity. Until that one began to come out in April that he had been decapitated by Al Qaeda in retaliation for France's intervention in Mali, and now these remains having been found, essentially. The latest, in one of these many, many sad hostage sagas that France has become embroiled in, because over the years it's paid hostage money, so it's seen as a country whose nationals it's worth abducting. That's a sad story coming out of Mali of this early part of the week.
Well, Alex, French President François Hollande made that confirmation in his Bastille Day speech. Very sad news. How involved is Hollande and his government in trying to get back Verdon? Get back Lazarevich.
Well, Well, it's interesting that we haven't had much news of Lerovich for a number of months, actually, or indeed of the six other French hostages in the Sahel region. And there are said to be 14 French hostages overall in West Africa. As I mentioned, France is one of the countries that over the years has paid ransom money. Now, in recent months, they said they won't pay ransom money anymore. To give you an idea, it's said that Western is worth about €1 million euros in hostage taking money. And so those nations that do pay ransom money, of course, are accused of sort of perpetuating this this process. We don't know. Of course, it all goes on behind the scenes. And governments always claim they've not paid ransom money. A French family was released. The Moulin Fournier family were captured in Cameroon earlier this year and released in April after a couple of months of captivity. But they were very, very high profile. There were seven members of the same family, including children. So the French government obviously made a plan there. But poor Serge Lazarevich and other engineers in their 50s are not getting the same treatment.
Well, one thing Francois Hollande will certainly be watching very carefully is the election day. What, about 12 days away, the first round of the presidential elections in Mali. So what's the atmosphere? Who are the main contenders? What are the issues?
Well, I think one name to sort of begin to know and to remember is IBK, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. He's the out-and-out favourite, the man with more resources than the other 27 candidates. But it's an intriguing election. It's got an astronaut running in it. It's got a Mormon running in it, which you might not expect in Mali. And it's even got a candidate whose main platform is to campaign for the postponement of the presidential elections.
Sounds like very interesting. I never knew Mali had an astronaut. Fascinating bunch of people by the sounds of it. But of course, at the same time, there is a UN peacekeeping force in Mali. Can you tell us what their role is? This? Are they supporting logistics of the election? Just how involved are they with this 28th of July election?
Very much so. I mean, the UN force, MINUSMA, is being paid for by the United States as United States is a contribution to this attempt to calm down this region after France having done the intervention in January. So France now pulling out still has about 3,200 troops here, but they're due to come down to 1,000 by the end of the year and to be replaced by MINUSMA. MINUSMA is still only about 7,000 troops strong, but it's due to expand to over 11,000, which will make it the third biggest peacekeeping operation in the world. It has a very important role in the electoral preparations, not least distributing voters' cards. They go out on UN planes. I'm sure ballot boxes will go on UN planes. I'm sure cast ballots will be brought back to the capital, Bamako, in UN planes. And, of course, UN peacekeepers playing a crucial role to keep the town of Kidal able to vote. Kidal in the northeast of the country, which is occupied still by Tuareg rebels. And at the same time, France has sort of pushed Mali to go ahead with this election on the 28th of July, but in a country where part of it is occupied. So it's very, very difficult to hold a national election in a country where you've still got an occupied town. And so the UN peacekeepers are strongly involved with sort of, making that a safe place to vote on the 28th of July.
Excellent stuff, Alex, and I'm sure we will catch up with you before that election as well. That was Alex Duval-Smith, our woman in Bamako. Thanks very much for joining us on the program.
We will be looking through the Italian front pages very shortly. Those that have caught the eye of David Pleasant, at least, he'll be joining us in the studio in a moment. Before he does, here's Il Genio and Pop Porno.
Bye.
the unmistakable sounds of pop porno by Il Genio.
Well, it's now time for us to leaf through this morning's Italian front pages with Monocle's own David Pleasant. Welcome to the show, David. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Phil.
Are you a fan of pop porno?
Yeah, I rather like that song.
Do you?
Yeah.
Good. Both pop and porno, he's a fan of, which is excellent.
Excellent stuff. Classy as always, Dominic.
Thank you.
Shall we start with a story you have about the state broadcaster dropping a beauty pageant?
That's right. La Repubblica's doing quite an interesting kind of debate piece. Rai, the state broadcaster, as you said, is dropping after a long, covering this since 1939 in one guise or other through radio or television. It's now deciding not to cover Miss Italia, the Miss competition, very famous competition there.
I like the idea that once upon a time it was covered by radio. I would suggest that the Miss Italy isn't a great radio prospect, but
no.
You know, maybe I don't understand broadcasting.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that was a better way to cover it in a way.
It might be a more acceptable way. Perhaps that's where it should go to now.
Maybe it can come to M24, to Monocle 24. Maybe we can suggest
Miss Italia.
Let's refer that one up the chain. Excellent.
What's quite interesting is that it's actually kind of leading to serious political debate. The president of the Chamber of Deputies, you might kind of compare her to the Speaker of the House of Parliament, has kind of come out in defence of Rai, saying this is a very modern and civilised move by the state broadcaster. She said that when she tours Europe, she finds it surprising that, you know, she doesn't see women selling yogurt and suitcases and so on TV adverts. But when she comes back to Italy, you know, that's the norm, that you have to have a woman on a product or on a TV advert. And she's actually proposing setting some kind of legal motion, really, to try and kind of defend the image of women through broadcasting.
Presumably, sorry Phil to interrupt you, presumably there is a vocal lobby, some of whom are probably beauty pageant contestants themselves, saying that this is outrageous, it should remain a national institution, and it's good for women, for their confidence and for various other things.
You're quite right, and in fact...
For bikini sales as well, I'm sure.
Bikini sales. One of the former Miss Italia, she was actually Miss Italia 2000, Tania Zamparo, has come out saying that, you know, Miss Italia is always encouraged, you know, brave ragazze, you know, very good girls to do, not good girls in a kind of old fashioned sense, as in kind of successful, talented young women to kind of achieve their goals and ambitions in life. And in fact, it always has attracted, you know, PhD students, you know, educated young women. So there are two sides to that argument. Although I think it's shifting away from at least kind of state broadcasting, and there's a lot less of the kind of Velina, the dancing girls, on state channels nowadays.
But there is a possibility that Miss Italia could get picked up by one of the satellite providers or one of the other cable channels.
Definitely, there's no doubt about that. But it's at least a move that it's going away from the state broadcasting.
I mean, you alluded there to this idea that you know, people go abroad and then return to Italy and are surprised anew by the fact that a scantily clad lady is apparently required to sell any product. Is there a wider debate that's being had in Italy about that issue, about this sort of, you know, broad kind of objectification for the purposes of commerce? I mean, everyone does it to some degree, but clearly it is a bigger deal in Italy.
Well, I think so. And I think it is that kind of migration to and froing from, you know, there's so many more young people are going abroad, coming back all the time, you know, on a weekly basis. And they're finding it that bit more kind of disturbing that they come back to Italy and they just see so many more legs and busts and all the rest of it. When they're in kind of Germany or Denmark, they don't see that kind of thing. So I think it is more current than ever, that debate.
Well, David, let's head down to Palermo. You've got a bit of a controversy happening there with the cathedral.
That's right. Now, Palermo, the capital of Sicily, was the focus of gay pride, the national gay pride this year, back in June. It's had a whole kind of season of pride activities as a result. And one event was actually projecting the symbol of the pride event, which was actually happened to be an asterisk, quite an innocuous little symbol, was projected onto the cathedral of Palermo. This has caused a huge kind of city debate. The cardinal has said that this is you know, is shameful. This, we've really touched the bottom.
Unfortunate use of words there, surely.
So that's badly translated, I think. We've reached the bottom.
Okay. So other than his amazing syntax to describe his concern about this, I mean, how widespread is concern? I mean, it did happen on a saint's day, I noticed, which I suspect would have given people even greater reason to think that their sort of objections have reason.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's a political thing. Various kind of sides have taken the sides of the church or otherwise. But the mayor, the Signore Orlando, has defended the gay pride, saying he's very proud that, and the symbol was meant to include all citizens of the city. You know, it's pride for everyone, not just the gay community. And I have to say, it isn't an offensive symbol if you look at it. It's literally just an asterisk. Mm. And this symbol was projected all over the city on all buildings, and it happened to hit the cathedral at some point. So I think it's a little bit of a storm in a teacup, but obviously not so if you happen to be the Cardinal of Palermo.
And finally, David, of course, we all know how amazing Italian food is, but it looks like there might be some fake made in Italy food.
Yeah, I mean, this is an ongoing thing. But what's quite interesting, this is from La Stampa, Turin's paper. It's reporting that Carabinieri is the police, the military police, who's dealing with some of this. They're finding more and more fakely marked or wrongly marked food that's saying it's made in Italy, with such kind of labels as DOP, which indicates provenance of a protected region. More and more of these products are being found, and that's thought to be, as we're approaching the summer season, more tourists are in Italy, more people wanting to buy these typical products, but a lot of them are not actually even made in Italy. It cites some pasta that's actually made in Holland, some onions here that are not from the region that they're certified at all.
Counterfeit rigatoni. How dare
I know. Well, I remember there was a story about counterfeit mozzarella last year, wasn't there? And the sort of organised crime fraternity was involved as well. So clearly that one rumbles on. That's all we've got time for today's show. David, thank you very much for joining us. And thanks too to Daphne Denis, who is the show's producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Tess McCann were its researchers, and the studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next up after the news, it's The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove.
And both Dominic and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.